ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 7th of May. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, close encounter. An Australian Navy helicopter pilot forced to take evasive action after a Chinese military jet fired flares. And click go the shears. A New South Wales shearer sets a new women's record. 358 ewes shorn in 8 hours.
Some of those sheep looked almost as big as her.
They were probably as heavy. She's not very big, but there's a big ticker in there.
Pulling up after the record, I didn't feel too bad. I was a bit stiff in the back, but I think the adrenaline was still running high.
First today, Israel has rejected a ceasefire proposal accepted by Hamas and is pushing on with its attack on the southern Gazan city of Rafah. It comes after Hamas accepted a deal negotiated by Qatar and Egypt. Aid officials are also warning northern Gaza is now in a state of full-blown famine as the war in Gaza enters its 8th month. Alison Shaw reports.
For the residents in Rafah in southern Gaza, there's been precious little to cheer about in recent months. But news that Hamas has accepted a ceasefire proposal saw people take to the streets in celebration.
I was very happy. I mean, an indescribable feeling. We even shouted, Allahu Akbar. We and the children said, we want a truce.
The joy is unnatural. I do not know how to describe my feeling. It is an extraordinary joy. Allah willing, it will go well.
The proposal was put forward by Egypt and Qatar, but those celebrations may be premature. Israel says a deal is still a long way off and will continue its military offensive in the besieged city. In Tel Aviv, hundreds of protesters joined the families of Israeli hostages, blocking roads to demand the Israeli government accept the deal. Shahamor Zahiro's elderly uncle is one of those being held in Gaza.
This delay tactics, Fitz dragon cannot continue even one day longer. We need them home now and we need the Israeli government to do the right thing.
Israel says the current proposal, which would begin with a 6-week ceasefire and the release of 33 Israeli hostages, is far from its core demands, but it will continue to negotiate. Military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari says Israel will continue its operations in Gaza for now.
We examine every answer and reply very seriously, and at the same time we continue our operations in the Gaza Strip and will continue to do so.
Those operations include airstrikes in Rafah, where about half of Gaza's 2.3 million people have been taking refuge. The Israeli Defense Force has ordered more than 100,000 people to evacuate the city. The displaced Palestinians still in Rafah are reflecting on their disappointment at Israel's response to the ceasefire deal.
We're holding our breath after Hamas agreed to the ceasefire, but unfortunately Israel still wants to attack and they're delaying their response. It's a big problem for us because if they stick to their word about the raid in Rafah, we won't find anywhere else to go. It will be very hard for us to move from Rafah to another place. There is no other place. There is no solution.
When the Israeli planes dropped leaflets asking us to evacuate, we were afraid and we didn't know what we should do. We were optimistic when Hamas agreed to the ceasefire proposal. We were very optimistic. But Israel procrastinated. They don't want to agree to a ceasefire and they want to raid Rafah.
The airstrikes and looming threat of a full-blown assault on the city is concerning the United Nations. Jonathan Fowler is a senior spokesman for the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA.
This is a huge population at risk. If people have to just keep going on the move again, basically, they're getting pushed beyond their breaking point. So anything which forces people to move around simply complicates the humanitarian operation for people who are already in an absolutely desperate situation.
US National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby says the moment comes at a critical stage in the negotiations. He also says the US will discuss the response with Israel.
We want to get these hostages out. We want to get a ceasefire in place for 6 weeks. We want to increase humanitarian assistance. And the last thing that I want to do is say anything at this podium that's going to put that process at risk.
US National Security Council spokesman John Kirby, ending that report by Alison Schau. The Australian government says it's used diplomatic and defence channels to express deep concerns about a Chinese jet detonating flares near an Australian naval helicopter. Flares were dropped just hundreds of metres ahead of the helicopter, which was taking part in a United Nations mission to enforce sanctions against North Korea. Defence experts say China's behaviour in international waters is becoming increasingly dangerous and putting lives at risk. Gavin Coote reports.
Unsafe and unprofessional is how Australia's Department of Defence described an incident near South Korea over the weekend. An Australian pilot was forced to take evasive action after a Chinese military jet fired flares close to a Navy helicopter flying over international waters.
It is incredibly dangerous.
Jennifer Parker served in the Navy for 20 years and is now an expert associate at the ANU's National Security College.
If the helicopter had ingested one of the flares into its engine, it could have shut down the engines on the helicopter. And we could have seen the helicopter need to ditch with potential injuries or loss of life. So this isn't normal by any stretch of the imagination.
The Seahawk helicopter was taking part in a United Nations mission to enforce sanctions against North Korea. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says Australia's raised its concerns with Beijing, but has not said whether he's spoken with President Xi Jinping.
We have made very strong representations at every level to China about this incident, which we regard as unprofessional and unacceptable.
While economic and diplomatic relations between Canberra and Beijing have improved in recent years, it's been less cordial on a military level. In a rare face-to-face meeting in China last week, the Chief of Australia's Navy, Mark Hammond, raised concerns with his Chinese counterpart about unsafe behaviour in international waters. It followed an incident last November in which Australian Navy divers were injured after being exposed to sonar pulses from a nearby Chinese warship while in the South China Sea. Jennifer Parker from ANU argues China's behaviour is a breach of international law.
So not only do we have the right of freedom of navigation, which is the right to navigate our ships in international waters, you also have a right of freedom of overflight. And the aircraft that was taking action to enforce UN sanctions against North Korea was conducting itself within international law. Impeding its flight path, I would interpret as a breach of international law.
Australia isn't alone in its concerns about aggressive behaviour from Chinese military forces. In a report to US Congress last October, the Pentagon said Chinese aircraft have engaged in almost 200 risky manoeuvres during US air operations in the Indo-Pacific since 2021. Some of the examples of what it called coercive behaviour from Chinese planes and jets include flying within metres of US aircraft, forcing them to take evasive action to avoid a collision. Michael Shoebridge, who's the Director of Strategic Analysis Australia, says such incidents are becoming more frequent and aggressive.
And any idea that this is just some individual pilots and ship's captains doing stuff that Beijing isn't aware of is clearly silly and wrong. This has to be a pattern of behaviour that is licensed and directed from the highest levels of the Chinese government.
While the Prime Minister's condemned China over the incident, Michael Shoebridge thinks he needs to pick up the phone with his Chinese counterpart.
Even if she refuses to listen, because guess what Mr. Albanese can do after that? He can tell the Australian public and the rest of the world that this is actually a policy that is agreed and enabled by the Chinese leader.
After meeting in Hawaii last week, the defence ministers of Australia, the US, Japan and Philippines have agreed to ramp up joint naval exercises in the South China Sea to counter China's military behaviour in the region. China has not responded publicly following the latest incident.
Gavin Coote. Let's go to New York now, where the former US President Donald Trump is on trial for criminally falsifying and hiding a hush money payment to an adult film star. After a few weeks of legal argument, it's finally getting to the heart of the accusation that Donald Trump had authorised and was aware of the purpose of the payment. Jared Monshine is the Director of Research at the US Studies Centre. We spoke earlier. Jared Monshine, today the court has heard from former Trump Organization accountant Deborah Tarasoff. What's she had to say?
I think after so many days of courtroom drama, 2 weeks of drama involving, you know, different scandals and sex, now they're looking at the actual documents within the Trump organization. They're looking at the business records. So what exactly was paid to whom? How was it paid? And why was it paid? And there's some folks, the Trump organization may be claiming that it was simple legal expenses. Michael Cohen, his former self-described fixer, said that he was reimbursed for paying money to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels. So ultimately, this goes into the sort of heart of the trial at hand in terms of the falsifying business records and not being accurate in terms of what these payments were for.
Indeed, her testimony was that he signed those checks himself, Donald Trump, and that his defense has been that he was detached or he was at arm's length from those checks or that process. Could her testimony undo that defense of his?
I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like it's a pretty clear case from one perspective that he knew exactly what these payments were for and that he told numerous people, including the former publisher of the National Enquirer, about what he was doing in regards to Stormy Daniels. So I think it seems like it's a clear case of what the intention was behind these payments. And I don't think his team, including his former staffers, have done very much to change the broad understanding of what these payments were for.
Do you think Americans are watching the trial in detail, or are they only checking in every now and then?
Well, according to polling, it seems like a majority are not paying attention to this trial. If there's anything we've learned about this Trump era in politics, is that there is a lot of noise and there's a lot of just endless media attention of him. But the question is, what sticks and what stays? And right now, I don't see many Americans as being undecided in this election. And therefore, I don't see many Americans really being influenced by how this court case turns one way or the other. Not only because Americans are in many ways fixed in their views of Donald Trump one way or the other, but also because this trial, according to legal scholars, is probably one of the weaker court cases that Trump is facing. Now, if this were a trial about what he did in Georgia, looking for votes to undermine the election, according to the prosecutor there, that is, I think, a different thing altogether. I don't think Americans, you know, they knew who Donald Trump was when he came into the limelight. His recognition in 2016 helped him, propelled him for the office and gain popularity and defeat the other Republican candidates. I don't think that his having allegedly paid off an adult film star is going to really change much for him. The issue at hand, I think, is broader, right? And I think that the challenge in this election is not necessarily changing opinions of Trump as much as getting people out to the ballot box. In many ways, this election may be one of the least popular elections for voting. Having this two same candidates that they had 4 years ago has not exactly enthralled Americans.
Jared Monshine, thanks for joining the world today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jared Monshine from the US Studies Center. This is the world today. Thanks for your company. It's most likely a tense day for anyone with a home loan. You're no doubt watching for signs of interest rate relief. The Reserve Bank will deliver its latest rates decision this afternoon, but rather than signalling a rate cut, problematic inflation means another rate hike might be back on the agenda. I spoke a short time ago with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, you'll be down at the Reserve Bank this afternoon. What are the chances of any rates movement?
Well, Rachel, money markets see an 85% chance the RBA's cash rate will be staying on hold at 4.35%. But that's down from 92% earlier today, so just an extreme outside chance of a shock interest rate hike, but it's a chance that's rising. And now we're accustomed to hearing the Reserve Bank promising to do whatever it takes to tame inflation to keep it within that 2 to 3% target band. But earlier this year, the language was softer, so soft that there was serious talk about interest rate cuts in the coming months. Now there's a pretty big spanner in the works. The quarterly inflation update out a couple of weeks ago shows that while the pace of inflation is slowing, it's not slowing fast enough. So expect a renewed tougher tone from the RBA board, that one, maybe two more rate hikes might be needed to kill off inflation. We'll also be seeing the release of the RBA's quarterly statement on monetary policy, updated forecasts on economic growth, unemployment, and importantly, inflation. And that's going to be closely watched by the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers.
And Peter, the head of the ANZ Bank has called out the pressures on borrowers who are doing it tough. Are there any signs that some households are at breaking point?
Well, Rachel, all of the big four banks say they've been on the front foot in dealing with mortgage stress. And today, the ANZ's chief executive, Shane Elliott, says households are resilient, but there's no doubt that borrowers and also renters are hurting badly. Mr. Elliott was speaking after the ANZ posted a 7% fall in half-year profit to $3.5 billion. Heavy competition means the ANZ's net interest margin dipped over the period. Now, that's a key measure of profitability, comparing the bank's funding costs with what it charges out for loans. But away from those dry numbers, Shane Elliott says the ANZ now uses technology to identify customers in distress 40 days out, and he's urged them to call out for help.
While most remain resilient, higher interest rates, taxes, rent, and household expenses are hurting many. The number of customers in hardship rose this half, and while still lower than it has been in the past, it's extremely distressing for each of them. And we expect that number to rise further as cost of living bites harder and unemployment likely increases. But I do want to assure those customers that we are here to support you.
That's ANZ Chief Executive Shane Elliott, and before him, Peter Ryan. The murders of six people at Bondi Junction and the alleged knife attack on a priest in Western Sydney have prompted the New South Wales government to introduce new laws to tackle knife crime. The legislation follows in Queensland's footsteps, where Jack's Law is in place. It gives police the power to wand or scan people for knives when they're in public places. The new laws will also include a ban on selling knives to children. Kathleen Ferguson reports.
In recent weeks, knife crime has been at the forefront of the minds of many in New South Wales. Despite official crime statistics showing knife-related offences are declining, a series of shocking stabbings have caused concern. Here's the Premier, Chris Minns.
Everyone would acknowledge that there's been a spate of high-profile, very disturbing, violent acts involving a knife in New South Wales in recent weeks. That, alongside the fact that the government is concerned with the rising number of particularly young people that seem to be possessing a knife in public spaces.
While numbers may be down overall, the Premier says the rate of stabbing-related deaths remains a worry.
In 2023, there were 56 murders in the state. 20 of those murders, so 36% of those murders, involved a knife being used. And in fact, if a weapon is used in a homicide in New South Wales, it's most likely to be a knife or stabbing implement that results in death.
The state government is introducing new laws, giving police greater search powers. Premier Chris Minns again.
The government will develop a reform proposal that will move amendments to raise the age of purchasing a knife from 16 to 18 in the state. We will increase penalties for those that sell a knife to a child under the age of 18, and we will change the Law Enforcement Powers and Protections Act in line with the Queensland Government's Jack's Law.
Under the proposal, he says senior police will have the authority to trigger search powers in a designated area for a 12-hour period, which can be extended. The measures would only apply where a knife or weapon-related crime has been committed in the previous 6 months. But that requirement won't be needed if it's a busy public place, like a train station, shopping centre or sporting precinct.
The intention of this legislation is, of course, to intercede and detect those that are carrying a knife in New South Wales. It's also to ensure that the public feels safe in major areas of crowds or public spaces.
He has acknowledged the changes might annoy some, but he's asked for patience.
It will inconvenience everybody. I just want to let the public know that there will be an inconvenience associated with wanding and scanning in New South Wales when the designation is turned on by New South Wales Police.
Dr. Xanthi Mallett is an Associate Professor of Criminology at the University of Newcastle. She says the measures make sense.
We've seen so much knife crime very recently that I understand the community is looking for further protections. And there seem to have been some positives out of Jack's Law in Queensland. So I'm not surprised that, you know, some lessons have potentially been learnt for that that will be applied to New South Wales. So I think the community will feel quite positive about the announcements today.
But she believes tougher laws on their own won't deter young people from carrying knives.
We don't want young people carrying weapons. People are getting hurt. But why are they carrying the weapons? How do we backtrack from that? How do we dissuade them from carrying the weapons? How do we convince them that this is not the way forward? So I think it needs to be more than, you know, at least a two-pronged attack. We need to look at this from that pro-social, getting involved with the communities, getting involved with these young people.
She says diversion programs and other initiatives connecting young people with their communities are essential.
We can't police our way out of this. And whilst that may be popular with the public, that's, you know, that tough on crime rhetoric always is a bit of a vote winner. We know that simply punishing young people is not the answer. And there are so many studies to demonstrate that. So we have to get smarter about this, and that will be to everybody's benefit.
Dr. Xanthi Mallett from the University of Newcastle, ending that report by Kathleen Ferguson. A 31-year-old woman from New South Wales has made world history, shearing more than 350 merino ewes in only 8 hours. Janine Kim has set a benchmark world record with her effort. One of the referees says she finished strong and gave an almighty performance. Stephanie Smale reports.
8 hours of shearing at speed is no small physical or mental feat, but in a shed at Cassilis in the New South Wales Hunter region, Janine Kim has done just that.
I didn't feel too bad. I was a bit stiff in the back, but I think the adrenaline was still running high, warding off any pain. But definitely yesterday, I was feeling it in the body.
The 31-year-old is the first Australian woman to attempt a shearing record of any kind and the first woman globally to attempt a shearing record with merino sheep. She's been shearing for 11 years and says she used her traditional Australian shearing method to finish the 358 merino ewes. Janine Kim welcomed the fact she was setting the world record, not trying to break someone else's.
We just wanted to see what we're able to achieve. And that is a privilege that we weren't trying to beat someone else's tally. But we just thought that might be a good starting point. So that's what we went with.
Mobility and weight training and 8 hours a day shearing for the past 12 months have helped her get in top condition. But she says it was also a team effort to get her through.
I didn't have time to look at the clock or see where I was at. So just my second mark, he was telling me exactly where I was. And then I had a timekeeper, Nikki Lyons, in the pen just telling me exactly where I was second-wise and where I was sitting against our target.
There's something the girls have got. They seem to prepare better than the blokes, as a rule.
Ralph Blue was a referee for Janine Kim's world record. He's seen a lot during his 35 years as a shearing contractor and was impressed by her effort.
Oh, too right I was. You know, anybody that puts themselves through that and they're still standing at the end of the day.
Some of those sheep looked almost as big as her.
They were probably as heavy. She's not very big, but there's a big ticker in there.
Ralph Blue understands the physical and mental strength it took for Janine Kim to set the benchmark.
Well, she's probably run 4 marathons in a day. You know, it's huge. She's dragged a lot of weight. She's had to get over every time a sheep kicked or something went wrong and get up again. And doing this for 8 hours, pretty hard.
Did that happen a lot? Were there many hurdles during that 8-hour stint?
Yeah, there is. Like, there's little things like a sheep might not come out properly when you catch it and you're catching it from the wrong position. Sheep can struggle. Some are faster shearing than others. And you have to get over all of that and keep going.
How would you describe watching her finish that 8-hour shear?
Well, she had a very strong finish. Normally the last run at a record is pretty rough and tough. Like, you're running on empty. There's no fuel left in the tank. It's just sheer guts and determination to get through to the finish.
Now the benchmark has been set, he's expecting other female shearers to try to beat it soon. And with women making up less than 4% of Australia's shearing workforce, the industry is hoping efforts like Janine Kim's will attract more women. Janine Kim says she's already noticing more women at work and she's hoping that will continue.
It's absolutely fantastic to see a lot more women taking it up and encountering a lot more women. Yeah, typically I suppose you do get a lot more men, but yeah, like there is a lot of really strong women out there shearing that you just don't hear about.
World record holder Janine Kim, ending that report by Stephanie Smale. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. In Australia, you have to be at least 13 to access social media. But given the content that can be posted online, is that really old enough? It's an issue that's occupying a lot of minds after the Bondi attack and two subsequent knife attacks in Sydney and Perth. So why don't we just ban smartphones for Australian kids altogether? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.